Today on The Whistleblowers, we take a look at war. Why? Well, because war is hell. As bad as war is, civil war is even worse. Neighbor versus neighbor, brother versus brother, even father versus son. Our guest today says Western countries like France, the UK, and even the United States are on the verge of a civil war. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Whistleblowers. In 2022, the European Union's foreign minister, Josep Borrell, said famously that Europe was a garden, contrasting it to the rest of the world, which he called a jungle. He took a lot of heat for that. Economic prosperity, political freedom, and social cohesion flourish inside the garden, in contrast to the jungle, outside. It's this arrogance that makes what I'm about to say very alarming. Europe could be on the brink of all-out civil war. How do we know? Well, because of three factors: immigration, economic decline, and the loss of trust in institutions. Immigration is tearing the West apart. President Trump came to power promising to build the wall. He tapped into a feeling that migrants are replacing natives and threatening their power, language, and culture, and no one voted for that. In his article, War Comes to the West, Dr. David Betts says this, quote, "The most unstable are moderately homogeneous societies, particularly when there is a perceived change in the status of a titular majority or a significant minority which possesses the wherewithal to revolt on its own," unquote. The numbers don't lie. The U.S. white population has dropped from 80% in 1980 to 60% in 2020. White births are only about 50% of the yearly total, and there are officially 15 million illegal immigrants in the U.S., although that number is likely higher. In France, the foreign-born population is between 10 and 13%. In the U.K., it's 16%, and in Germany, it is nearly 20%. Murders, rapes, and violent crimes continue to take place in cities across the United States. President Trump has deployed the National Guard to Washington, D.C., and citizens are jailed for speaking out on social media. They feel like strangers in their own country, and poor strangers at that. Across the West, real wages have stagnated while income inequality has skyrocketed. Since 1979, wages for the bottom 90% of the population in the United States have grown 15% compared to 138% for the top 1%. Combine that with deindustrialization and the threat of AI, and there is a growing feeling that things will never get better. Meanwhile, citizens see their governments as illegitimate. Confidence in voting and elections is plummeting. A majority of Trump voters believe that the Democrats stole the 2020 election, while a majority of Democrats believe that Donald Trump stole the 2016 election. It's no better in the European Union, where courts overturned a recent Romanian presidential election. Put all of this together, and what do you get? You get a spiral into civil war across the West. As Professor David Betts puts it, we used to have homogeneous, functioning societies. Now, quote, "by contrast, all are now incohesive political entities, jigsaw puzzles of competing identity-based tribes living in large part in virtually segregated communities, competing over diminishing societal resources, increasingly, obviously, and violently." Joining us to discuss is Dr. David Betts. He's a professor of war studies at the Department of War Studies at King's College London. Dr. Betts, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Appreciate you being here. So let's start here. Is civil war, in your view, inevitable in the West? And if the answer is yes, where do you think it might be most likely to spring up?
Well, inevitable is a strong word. I'd say very likely. Where it's likely to spring up is an interesting question, because there are so many potential first prize winners in this rather dismal race. Currently, I would say that the UK and France, as you mentioned, are very very close to the edge, and increasingly so. But some smaller countries are also. If I was to lay a bet on the question that you've just asked, I would probably say Ireland, because it suffers from all of the problems, which no doubt we'll get into, but it also is a country which has a recent history of civil conflict, which is an important factor when you think about the potential. At any rate, the question is also one which is not moot, but also is somewhat less penetrating than you might think, because the truth of the matter is that once it kicks off in one place, it's likely to spread mm-hmm. to another. So it doesn't really matter who goes over the finish line first. The chances of it propagating from one place to another are very, very high, I would suggest, because of the connectedness of these societies and of the commonalities of the problems. So in short, I'd probably say Ireland, but France, the UK, Germany, others, it could be in any number of them.
You've written about downgrading. Can you tell us what downgrading is and why it creates such volatile conditions?
Downgrading is the academic term for what in popular discourse is generally more commonly called the replacement or great replacement. So downgrading is a somewhat more anodyne term used by academics to refer to a situation in which a dominant or formerly dominant majority fears that it is losing its place in that society. So it fears that it is, that its language is losing its status as the lingua franca, that its cultural and legal ideals are being diminished, that are less dominant in that society. And the point here with downgrading is that this isn't a kind of temporary phenomenon. It is a permanent alteration of the dominance potential within that society, and it tends to be provide a very powerful impetus to civil conflict, because as that dominant majority or formerly dominant majority is losing its status, it feels a growing sense of urgency to do something about it. And so once the idea enters into the public sphere, once this idea intrudes into the collective psyche of that society, it tends to be very self-reinforcing, mm-hmm. And so it can accelerate very rapidly. In short, downgrading is an academic term which one will come across in the Civil War's causational literature, but people are familiar with the concept if they've come across the, as you mentioned in your introduction, if you've come across people talking about the perception of being replaced in their own society, of losing their countries, of natives becoming essentially displaced, deracinated, disconnected from their homelands, and it's a very powerful incentive to civil conflict.
What is the nature of this conflict going to look like, do you think? And we're in this era of drone and missile warfare. Do you expect actual battles, rockets flying, guerrilla warfare? The reason why I ask is because in the most recent conflicts we've seen, We see things like drones, as I said, suicide drones even, that aren't supposed to fly back to base. They're just used as missiles themselves. We see these robot dogs a la Black Mirror on Netflix. We see organizations like DARPA here in the United States developing robot soldiers. All they're waiting on now is to perfect a battery, for example. So what do you think one of these conflicts might actually look like?
It's a quite complicated question, and it'll take me a moment to explain. But essentially, I see three primary belligerents emerging after a period of accelerating after a period of escalation. And those belligerents are the post-national elite, which tends to be politically dominant across the West. The United States is an exception to this because the Trump administration is avowedly a national one. But if one looks across the West European states, these are countries which are governed by nominally national leaders who are themselves post-national in their orientation. They don't think in terms of national interest. They think that's actually a rather disreputable mode of thinking. They're very suspicious of that. And one can see that in the kinds of their reactions, policies they favor, their efforts generally in the public sphere. So you have a post-national elite that is one of the major belligerents. You also have the more recent non-native populations, the migrant populations, that not all of which are, strictly speaking, new. Some of these, in most countries, you have these are now multi-generational, but fully non-integrated. So they, you know, that we have places throughout the Western world now where effectively they are sort of colonial enclaves. They're living in the West, but fully connected into their diasporic communities, and largely functionally non-integrated. And in many cases, in the worst cases, here in the UK, with the rape gangs essentially predatory on their new countries. And then you have the native populations. Now, if you think of these, you have structurally, you're talking about an elite which is, let's say, between 5 to 10, maybe 15% of the population. You have roughly the same numbers when you think about the fully non-integrated and essentially undigestible non-native population. And then you have the big mass in the middle, which is, for the most part, in a condition of having been politically neutral or rather inert for many years, unresponsive to what's happening around it. But this is rapidly changing. And again, as you mentioned in the introduction, fundamentally it comes down to the realization on the part of the formerly dominant majorities that identity politics is the rules of the game. That is the way it works, and therefore the native, or in this conversation, essentially the white population, has realized that it needs to operate as do all other identity groups. So you have these three groups. Mm-hmm. That gives rise to conflict which essentially has what I call two vectors, one in which the native population seeks, on the one hand, to punish the post-national elite for its, essentially, for its multi-decade project of deracination of these populations. And so that form of conflict has something of the character of a peasant revolt.
Well, may I interrupt you on that, on that specifically? Peasant revolts take place all around the world, but not in nuclear powers, not in developed Western countries with centuries of democratic tradition. How is that going to look? Are we talking here about maybe a mass casualty event? Are we talking about shortages of food, water, power, sanitation even?
Yeah, if I may, maybe I'll complete my previous thought and circle back to your second question. So the second vector of conflict is between the native and non-native, and that has more the nature of a kind of Balkanized or Lebanized intertribal conflict. It's in some sense and likely to be much larger, and it has much more potential to metastasize in ugly ways, as one saw in Yugoslavia, or as I said, Lebanon, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of what it looks like, each of these two vectors has quite different character. The first vector, in the peasant revolt, or I think, is likely to have a character that is something like that of the Latin American style dirty war, which is characterized by essentially by kidnapping, by assassination, by targeting of influencers, or probably legal figures, I would guess, judges, lawyers in Western context, are very prominent in this, and are traditionally a very common target in that sort of thing, in that sort of conflict. So the thing with a dirty war is that, unlike, say, the American Civil War or the English Civil War of four centuries past, these are not conflicts that are characterized by the clash of large uniformed armies. They're rather more of the nature of something like Northern Ireland or something like that. The violence is chronic but low level. The intertribal conflict is one that has more potential for mass scale, but even there, I don't see it metastasizing into a large-scale conventional conflict in which, we would see organized, semi-regular, uniformed armies fighting each other. Rather, what I expect, on account of the way in which, essentially on demographic factors, on urbanization and the like, that it will be characterized fundamentally by infrastructural attack on the major cities, where most of the non-native population is concentrated. There's a very distinct difference that is very easily represented on a map if you look at voting patterns. It's a very clear thing. So essentially, you'd have critical infrastructure attacks on the cities where the non-native populations are most dominant, with a view to creating conditions in these city centers mm-hmm. that are so intolerable that people that people leave, or at least that will be the strategic logic.
Dr. Betts, stay right there. We're going to have to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to have more with Dr. David Betts, our guest, on the inevitability of civil war in the West. Stay tuned. You're watching The Whistleblowers. Welcome back. We're talking about the inevitability, the likelihood of civil war in the West today with our guest, Dr. David Betts. Dr. Betts is a professor of war studies at the Department of War Studies at King's College London. Thanks for staying with us, Dr. Betts.
No problem.
So are we able, do you think, as nations, to walk ourselves back from the brink? And if we can't, what can the government do? What can people do to prepare for something like this? Is it too late, for example, for mass remigration?
That's a good question. Honestly, it's a hard one for me, because I'm not really talking about tactics. I'm not talking about the individual level. I'm not a prepper. It's very long since I served in uniform. So I struggle to give a very good answer on that one. But if I'm to be precise, I would say I don't think there's much chance of walking away from this. I think in hindsight, you know, when the history of this period is written up 20 or 30 or 40 years hence, they will consider that things were actually already started by 26, by certainly by 25, 24 even. If you wanted to avoid what was happening, you should have done things 10 or 12 years ago.
Right.
Maybe even 15. So the powder's already been stacked. And the fuse, I think, has also been lit, if I'm honest. I think, therefore, or my advice to government, for what it's worth, is not so much to government, frankly, is possibly to the security services or to the permanent part of the government, is that you should prepare for mitigation. There are certain things to expect that occur in civil wars that are notably damaging, and one can do things that might mitigate those effects. So I would be thinking about that, how you minimize the loss of life, how you minimize the physical cultural destruction that is typical in civil conflicts. I know that's a pretty dismal answer. Maybe smarter, more energetic people than I can come up with ways of getting out of this problem, but frankly, I don't see one. As for individuals, ultimately, what I've described is a result of a process of tribalization. And there's a limit to what any individual can do to secure themselves. You know, the toughest, you know, John Rambo, he still has to sleep. He only has eyes on the front of his head. You need to find your tribe. You need to know your neighbors. You need to find a community, and you need to live to a large extent more in the manner that your ancestors did, for much the same reasons, right? We cannot go on being so anonymous and so disconnected from each other. And people perceive this clearly, which is why we're seeing these retribalization effects. But if I was to advise anybody on, you know, what to do about this, I guess I would say is, do you know your neighbors?
Right.
And if you don't, then you probably should. You mentioned remigration. I think that is, I think the conflict which I'm describing is going to end in one way or another. It will end with the extinguishment of Western civilization. It's probably not too dramatic, but to put it more specifically, it will end with the extinguishment of a number of historic European nations, or it will end with their restoration. But neither of those is going to occur without violence.
And
both of those are...
In the end, can there be a winner in this thing? Or does everybody lose?
Well, probably yes. It's going to be painful. History is, it's, you know, you can't really talk about history in terms of winners and losers.
Right.
History's far too complicated for that. We will come to a decision on this. There are forces in motion which are profound and will exercise the imagination of historians for a long time since our own. And it's going to be very painful. And I think people need to buckle down and accept that.
Well, Dr. David Betts, thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Betts is a professor of war studies at the Department of War Studies. That's at King's College London. Civil war really is no joke. In fact, it should terrify each and every one of us. Just look at the death toll that these civil wars have taken in the past. In the 1930s, the Spanish Civil War left 500,000 dead. That was about 2% of the population. And it left Spain open to becoming a testing ground for weapons that would be unleashed on the world in the Second World War. The Russian Civil War was perhaps the deadliest in history, leaving between 7 and 12 million people dead, in addition to the 2 million soldiers who were killed in World War I. And the American Civil War left close to 700,000 people dead and was the deadliest war for the United States in its history. I'm not saying all of this to scare you. I'm really not. I'm saying all of this to warn you. Civil war might be coming, and we should all be prepared. And it isn't just me saying this. High-profile senators like Rand Paul of Kentucky are now sounding the alarm bell on the possibility of a civil conflict. To quote Dr. Betts one last time, quote, "As history has often shown, wars long in the making appear sudden only to those who have refused to read the signals." That's our show for today. Please subscribe to my Substack at John Kiriakou. Stay informed, and as always, keep asking the hard questions. I'm John Kiriakou. Thanks for watching The Whistleblowers.